Welcome to Spectator Out Loud, the podcast where every week we pick a few of our writers in the magazine to read their pieces out to you. This week we'll be joined by Kate Andrews, our economics correspondent, who writes about why she's voting for Joe Biden despite being a lifelong Republican. Then we'll be joined by Matthew Paris, who gives the recommendation to go to Sweden while you still can. And at the very end, Rory Sutherland wonders whether or not he's cracked COVID testing. First up, Kate Andrews.
For as long as I was old enough to think about politics, I've been a Republican. When my dad told me, age 6, that Bill Clinton had beaten Bob Dole, I'm told I cried. I don't remember this, but I do have vivid memories of running around St. Andrews in my first year at university in a handmade McCain Palin t-shirt with "No Obama" sketched in Sharpie on the back. I graduated into an internship on Mitt Romney's campaign, and when I moved to London, I became a spokesman for Republicans overseas. Never in my wildest dreams would I have imagined the first time I voted Democrat would be to put Barack Obama's vice president in the Oval Office. Yet, I'm voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I know their economic policies will make America poorer, especially as the economy tries to recover from COVID-19. The tax rises and the huge increase in spending, the kind that Senator Biden used to be wary of. And this is now the moderate wing of the party. Biden's VP pick is even further to the left. Harris's approach to governing would be even more top-down and interventionist. Her politics and mine, I'm a liberal in the British sense of the word, are about as far apart as one can get. But what about the alternative? What about Donald Trump? The nastiness, unkindness, the racism and misogyny, the way he always punches down rather than up, is the antithesis not just of my politics, but of the America that I love. His supporters claim his remarks are taken out of context by his opponents in the media, that what he says is made to sound worse than what he meant. But we've all watched enough clips to know that the president needs no embellishment. The only way to pretend he didn't propose a ban on Muslims coming to the United States is to close your eyes and pretend you didn't read it on his campaign website. The only way to claim he didn't mock a reporter's physical disability is to look away and pretend that it never happened. After 8 lackluster years under President Obama, I felt as if a shift was coming. Sure, I had my personal favorites in the lineup of Republican candidates, the ones with a libertarian streak, but at the start of election season, you would have struggled to find an expat more excited to make the case abroad for the GOP candidate. My enthusiasm fell away when Trump called Mexicans rapists. This was unforgivable, not that he has ever asked for forgiveness. The party of Ronald Reagan didn't demonize migrants in this way, but Trump did. In the end, a major shift did come, but I didn't take part. This isn't to say I begrudge Trump voters. The vitriol thrown at them often mirrors how the president treats his critics, and his supporters are right to point to his policy successes. Trump's tax reforms have resulted in companies big and small hiking wages and dishing out bonuses for American workers. It's not a terrible surprise to us free market lot, but his combination of lower taxes and light touch regulation produced a booming economy before the virus hit. Last year saw a spectacular 6.8% rise in household medium income, the highest increase since records began. His less interventionist stance on the world stage has saved countless lives abroad. The First Step Act has done more to reform criminal justice and help nonviolent offenders rehabilitate than any Republican or Democrat policy in years. In this sense, the president has been good for America, and I have asked myself many times if I can separate the man from his words, hold my nose, and cast my vote for the continuation of these policies. The answer is always no, because what is at stake is bigger than the economy, bigger than any piece of legislation that could cross the president's desk. The social fabric of America is coming undone, and if it unravels much more, I fear it won't be possible to stitch it back together. I've never felt further away from my home country than I did this summer. Sitting in my London flat during lockdown, watching on TV, as the divisions that had been stoked in American society for years reach breaking point. Trump thrives on chaos and ego. After the murder of George Floyd, he quickly made the protests and riots about him personally, as if he were the victim of police brutality, or as if setting fires to shops and cars was more of an attack on him than on the Americans watching their businesses and possessions burn to the ground. Trump hasn't been alone in fostering instability. Many factions of the Democratic Party never accepted that he won the 2016 election fairly and tried to use every tool they could to overturn the result. But Trump has encouraged everyone to meet him at the basis level. Lauren Witzke, a Republican candidate for the Senate, shared just days ago her belief that most third world migrants cannot assimilate into civil societies, as if this were now a socially acceptable way to speak about other human beings in America. Ms. Witzke is responsible for her own words, but the president has created an atmosphere in which people feel emboldened to share these beliefs. This is a culture that arises when a nation's leader never embraces humility, compromise, or anything remotely resembling a statesmanlike demeanor. The first presidential debate reminded me once again that Trump has not bothered to learn any of these lessons. The interrupting, yelling, and spin were bad enough, but the dismissal of Beau Biden, when the former vice president was paying tribute to his late son, was one of Trump's most inhumane moments to date. It's hard to imagine a person could stoop much lower, and yet I can't help but think, given four more years, Trump wouldn't hesitate to show us. In 2016, I broke with the Republican Party for the first time and supported the Libertarian candidate. I vote in a solidly Democratic state, so I had the luxury of casting a protest vote against a system that made Americans choose between two members of the New York elite, the least popular presidential candidates in history, both of whom acted as though becoming president was their birthright rather than the highest privilege. But this time, I'm protesting by joining the other side. There is a candidate in this race who, while far from perfect, has a history of reaching across the aisle. He has based his campaign on reuniting the nation, and perhaps most importantly in this election cycle, has reminded us that it's okay to apologize now and again. America does not have a monarchy. The president is our head of state and our moral compass. Trump has proven time and time again that he is unfit for these roles. I like to believe a Republican leader is waiting around the corner to restore the values and principles that once made the party great. Until then, I'm happy for the Oval Office to be filled by someone who has a different vision for America than I have, but who loves the country and what it stands for nonetheless.
That was Kate Andrews. And now, Matthew Paris.
An idea gains ground that we shouldn't go abroad anymore, that the very act of travelling without urgent reason is somehow irresponsible. I don't subscribe to this. To me, travel has always been such an important and productive part of life, a source of knowledge and happiness. So while I can travel, I will. But quarantine is making it harder. My partner and I belong to what one survey reports is the 18% of quarantined people who actually do stay at home. Much as I love our Derbyshire home, 14 days quarantined in one corner of the Peak District is a serious deterrent from visiting most of the rest of the world. But not from visiting Sweden, yet. As I write, their COVID case rate is about a quarter of Britain's, and our requirement to quarantine does not apply to people arriving from Stockholm. Nor do the Swedes make British visitors quarantine. So off we went on a four-day trip to a country very close to these islands, but which millions of us hardly know. True, I once spent a New Year in a log cabin in the woods in central Sweden. Fun, but we saw only snow and trees. Otherwise, my last visit was half a century ago. Since then, I felt I knew Sweden only by reputation. That reputation proved so very wide of the mark. Call me ignorant, and I was, but my childish idea of the country was of a sort of frontier land, a few modest conurbations around Sweden's Baltic and North Sea coast, and then vast swathes of coniferous nothingness punctuated by the occasional clapboard barn and some sweet little Lutheran churches, stretching up towards the North Pole. Culturally, I'd, again ignorantly, suppose that apart from Strindberg, a playwright whose work I find impenetrable, and of course ABBA, well, what else was there beyond Europe's most successful purveyor of flat-pack furniture? Politically, I'd thought of Sweden as slightly sanctimonious, much into good work among the non-aligned and developing countries and ducking the big issues. Domestically, I'd supposed this was the ultimate cradle-to-grave welfare state, dispiritingly level, unmaterialistic, conformist, distrustful of wealth or display, and characterized by a faint antiseptic odor of self-righteousness. Well, 4 days into Stockholm and Gothenburg, and the journey between them put me right. That's plainly far too short a time to forge a rounded impression of a great nation, and Scandophile readers will be laughing at me already, laughing at how little I know even now. But how much less did I know before I went? If a nation can be said to have DNA, Sweden's DNA is of a boss nation. Pennants in their national colours of blue and yellow fly from flagpoles on people's lawns. Like us, they've lost an empire, in their case a European one. And like us, they do feel special. Everything from their amazing galleries and museums to their tremendous warship, the Vasa, sunk in 1628 and now raised, preserved and displayed in a vast and beautiful museum the size of 2 aircraft hangars, 6 floors high, everything from their very slightly aloof courtesy to their ability to laugh at themselves and at each other, breathes self-assurance. Stockholm is magnificent, reminding me in some ways of Edinburgh. Not charming, not quaint, and not in the feminine sense beautiful. Perhaps the capital has a certain lack of what one might call grace, but it's handsome, intelligent, solid, monumental, conscious of its architectural personality and resolved to cherish it. Wide streets, lovely parks, strict limits on the heights of buildings, and everywhere the little touches, flourishes, trademarks of a city that knows all about display but has a sharp aversion to vulgarity. From the skinny black jeans to the black leather accessories to the rock walls and soaring artwork of the underground stations, I can think of no national culture with so strong a sense of style. And where had all the fat people gone? Most people of my age work out, go to gyms, a waiter told me. And the older people? They walk, cycle, exercise at home. I did finally spot 3 obese people at a table near us at one of the city's hundreds of pavement cafes. They were English. We missed by 2 days the opening of a new opera by Rufus Wainwright in the city's Grand Opera House. On one day, we were impulse buying an ultra-smart pale green coffee percolator, wandering the 6 floors of what must surely be Europe's most elegant and high-end department store. NK in Stockholm, so much less crass than Harrods, is on some kind of a cusp between the old pre-John Lewis Peter Jones in Chelsea, the old Liberty off Oxford Street, and Wanamaker's in Philadelphia. A day later, we were walking a nature trail beneath oak, birch and pine trees where the earth bleeds black on the granite-strewn Struso Island off Gothenburg. And after that, shrimps and roast smoked salmon outside a little restaurant beneath the chestnut trees, then back by ferry to Gothenburg after nipping into a public loo that you paid by credit card to enter. Sweden, it sometimes felt, is what in the 1950s the world of the future was going to be like, but it never happened, except in Sweden. And I discovered Nordic art. At the Gothenburg Museum of Art and at the Thielska Galleriet in the woods outside Stockholm, where Swedish ladies who lunch sip dry white wine to a backdrop of a postcards of Eugene Janssen's paintings of naked men diving, we encountered mainstreams of European painting from the 1500s through Rembrandt and Van Dyck to the Nordic Expressionists of the early 20th century. Who knew that Edvard Munch painted not only Nietzsche, but his ghastly Nazi anti-Semitic sister, Elizabeth, too? To the British mind, the idea of Sweden seems to hover on the European fringe. Spend even a few days in its powerful gravity field, and the country feels close to the centre of our continent and its heritage. Hurry there while we still can.
That was Matthew Paris, and now Rory Sutherland.
The COVID problem lies as much in the delayed action of the virus as in the virus itself. Since symptoms emerge only days after infection, testing often comes too late to reveal how transmission occurred, and often too late to prevent onward transmission, since many people may be most contagious before symptoms even appear. This delay makes the targeting of restrictions far more complex, a bit like weather forecasting, only in reverse. For this reason, what we may have to fear most from bioterrorism is not the pathogens that are most deadly, but those with a delayed action. Now, if COVID had immediate effects, say your hair instantly turned purple when you were infected, we might have cracked the problem by now. Yet we still don't know, say, whether the size of the initial dose affects the severity of the disease. That would affect the case for masks, for instance. We also don't know what causes superspreading events. Is it the location or the person? Are some people largely insusceptible? One serious theory suggests the internal shape of your nose may have a bearing on the outcome. It all falls within that area of human knowledge where science falls short. You neither have quite enough information, nor can you ethically perform experiments to fill the gaps in your knowledge. This was not quite so difficult in 1721. Charles Maitland, a Scottish surgeon, received a royal licence to conduct an experimental inoculation, or variolation, on sick subjects who were deliberately exposed to a small dose of smallpox. All were inmates of Newgate Prison, and were granted a full pardon in the event that they survived. Happily, all six did. Later, one was deliberately exposed to smallpox, and it turned out he was immune. So it occurred to me there must be many prisoners today who'd welcome a similar offer and whose release would pose no risk to anyone. Bernie Madoff, perhaps, or those men behind that vault raid in Hatton Garden. None of these people was violent, and the vault's customers were probably every bit as dodgy as the people who broke in. The main reason for their long sentences is simply to deter others from similar acts. Now, it might be that, living as I do in West Kent, I have excessive sympathy for people who perform large-scale heists, given how much they contribute to our local economy. Nonetheless, I wondered if you could offer younger such inmates the same deal that was available in 1721. So, in a step rare in British journalism, I decided to share my suggestion with someone who knows what they're talking about. In this case, Nir Eyal, Professor of Bioethics at Rutgers in New Jersey. And what he told me was fascinating. Such trials, where you deliberately expose people to infection at various levels, are known as challenge trials. Many scientists believe that it may be impossible to test the full efficacy and safety of any potential vaccine without them. And there's also a growing scientific consensus that any such vaccine trials will accelerate the development of coronavirus vaccines, potentially saving hundreds of thousands of lives. Moreover, to be fully robust, such trials often require a control group, people exposed to the virus who have been given a placebo, not the real trial vaccine. This action presumably reveals what causes protection in those successfully vaccinated. E.g., it's only by performing challenge trials of this kind that you can reliably see the correlations that reveal which antibody successfully vaccinated people have developed that others haven't. An organisation called OneDaySooner.org already has about 40,000 volunteers around the world who are happy to take this risk. In reality, only 100 or so would be needed for a useful trial, though. But there are still two questions. If the case for such trials is compelling, might it not have made sense to have performed just a few of these trials a few months earlier in the pandemic, to better investigate in individuals the early stage of infection, about we still know far too little? And another question, do we really believe that a few countries haven't secretly done this already?
That was Rory Sutherland. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.